Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Studio team.
I'm Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team. And today we have...
I'm Hoi from also the Developer Relations team.
Hi, my name's Mate. I'm from the Android ML Engineering team.
Excellent. Right. ML Engineering. So I'm thinking that means that we're going to talk about engineering.
Yeah, though it is, I think ML is a really large topic. So maybe we could try to figure out what part of that space we're going to talk about today.
Well, that's very good. That's a very good question. Ahead. We have collisions already. We're off to a good start. That's a very good question, actually. I think the way we like to think about our mission is that we try and make on-device machine learning useful to Android developers by giving them useful tools to actually use on-device machine learning.
So machine, like running a model that you've already taught in the past or actually doing the learning on device or both?
Our work is primarily focused on inference. There are very many good cases where you would want to do on-device training as well. For example, to personalize a model to the user that's using the device. But typically you train server-side and then you transfer a model onto the device just for inference.
I see. So we still call that learning. So machine learning on the device primarily means using what it has learned during training to apply inference on the device.
Yeah, that sounds like a good summary.
So okay. I guess it's sort of like you take a test in class and we count it as part of learning, but really it's about testing. It's about validation that you actually learned the thing. So yeah, it's semantics. So in the past, we had, I think, just one episode on machine learning. In the past, we talked to Anna Goldie from the Brain team. What a lovely name for a team name. About TensorFlow and about like creating models and machine learning overall. So maybe we'd sort of start there and say, okay, well, machine learning is huge and there are various different parts. There's training the model, there's stuff that happens on the cloud, and then there's the stuff that we're going to focus on today, which is on device. Can you like paint us a picture of like the surface area of where do we see machine learning? Like, how does all this stuff fit together?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So if I could maybe lay out not so much points, but maybe like a spectrum. So on the one hand, we have MLKit, which are pre-trained on device model, the best in class, we believe, from Google that you can run through very simple APIs. And then on the other end of the spectrum is, think about custom models that developer train themselves, either using their own data set or have a very novel kind of structure. And one example that I might give is, for example, if you have a noise cancellation algorithm of some kind that is ML-based. And then in the middle, there's a whole spectrum of customization that you can do. So it's not like it's not just, hey, I can basically either use MLKit or I have to train a completely custom model. There is this whole spectrum that we can talk about, you know, on the one end, MLKit, on the other end, completely custom kind of TensorFlow-like models.
Can you say more about customizing something that's been pre-trained? Like how, if I download a, you know, TensorFlow Lite model, mm-hmm. and I want to run it. Like, how can I customize it?
So there are certain techniques, for example, that we call transfer learning, where you could use most of the model that's already trained, and most of the layers essentially allow you to detect different features within the image, for example, or the body of text. But then in the last couple of layers, you might want to classify them slightly differently. So you might not want strawberries and chairs. You want different breeds of dogs or different breeds of cats. And by allowing yourself to essentially relax the last couple of layers, then you can retrain a model that have learned a ton already from a much bigger data set and customize it to your own liking. So that's one technique that we have seen that is super effective.
It's very interesting. Yeah. How? Keep talking about that because I'm very interested in this.
And
so
maybe
let's say I download like an object detection model.
Yeah.
And you know, like it can recognize laptop and cell phone. This is actually an experiment that I've done, right? And let's say I wanted to teach it to distinguish what kind of cell phone. how do I do that? So I have a bunch of, you know, cell phones laying around. So presumably I could take some pictures of them. How do I now go and sort of take this model? What tools do I use? And how do I add that ability into the model, right? To recognize specific different kinds of, let's say, pixel devices.
Sure. So on that one, and Matej might want to kind of jump in and add additional points. Is that for particular use cases that is like this, the TensorFlow team have actually put together a product called the TensorFlow Model Maker that you can go ahead and try out. So what that does is it allow you to select a base model. Like you said, you know, you might have a object classifier that you're already kind of working with. EfficientNet and MobileNet are some of the more popular ones for mobile use. And then you essentially give that Python script a bunch of examples of different cell phones, etc., putting them into different directories, and it just picks that up from there, and it will run the training for you, and you can monitor the accuracy that's coming out. And you might want to trade off, hey, how many images do I want to give it? What different kind of background do we want to have those images in? You know, would those, some of those be underexposed? Would those be taken, you know, from an angle, etc., versus the accuracy? A lot of that tooling is in place. And Matej, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I think that's essentially it. So transfer learning is a super useful technique. So basically take advantage of the large amounts of data that have been used to pre-train the model and then just customize it. And I think with today's TensorFlow and TensorFlow-like tooling, this is effectively a very easy thing to do, even for developers who, you know, may not have a PhD in machine learning. Now, of course, the next question is, how do we use the model? We have a model, how do we use it? And this is where, you know, our problem space really, really starts. What tools do we give developers to run these models? How do we help them make sure that they run across, you know, a large number of Android devices? How do we make sure they use hardware acceleration where it's appropriate? And those sorts of challenges.
Yeah, I just want to add one more question before we move on to that. So in my case, then, if I want to teach it a bunch of additional specific cell phones, let's say, and you mentioned something about the background, how much of that original model will understand that, hey, I only care about what's sort of different about the phone, not the background? You know, like, do I have to be very careful that I lay out my own phones with exact same background? Or if one of them happens to be on a table, is that going to completely confuse the model? Like, is the background color going to confuse it, or does it already understand object segmentation?
So it's very unlikely that different background colors will confuse the model. So the models which are pre-trained are typically very deep models, which means that they have a lot of layers. And with the large data set that we use to train those models, essentially the model learns how to perform feature extraction out of an image. So if you visualize the training process, for example, the initial layers will be looking for horizontal vertical lines. And then a few layers down the line, you'd be looking at, you know, wavy shapes. And then again, 20, 30 layers down the line, you'd be detecting, you know, animal eyes, wings, different types of shapes. And with transfer learning, we take advantage of all of that, extract the features, and then you tell us how to classify the image.
I see. So when I sort of drop my 10 additional images of different kinds of phones in there, it'll understand a lot about those phones. And really, it'll probably only, you know, record things like, well, this one's taller and this one's wider and this one has a different bezel or whatever. Like that'll happen automatically then.
Yeah, so it's kind of difficult to describe exactly which features. You know, it's difficult to talk about, okay, you know, it's looking at the shape of the bezel. But in general, the model, having been trained on such a large data set with the appropriate model architecture, will be able to extract all the relevant features to allow you to classify into a specific model phone.
So I've heard both of you say the word layers many times now, and you mean something very different or something very specific about layers. Can you give us an explanation of like what's actually going on under the hood? And what are these layers of information from the machine learning side?
Sure. Yeah. So if you visualize, say, a modern image, you know, classification model, you will see that they can have, you know, several tens to several hundred of layers. Essentially, what happens is the input goes in, you know, from the left, and then each layer will produce an output. The output of that layer will feed into the next layer, and so on. And during training time, what actually happens is, as the input gets to the end of the model, we compare the prediction that the network has made, say, you know, this is a pixel 3, compared to the truth that you've given, the developer has provided to us in the data set. And then we go back, this is called backpropagation, we go back through the model and update the model parameters in the direction, which means that this input image would produce the desired output. And that's how a neural network actually learns.
Okay, and then I also had a follow-up. When Tori was saying, so I want to update my model and I've got, you know, these 10 other devices, 10 pictures of devices, like that seems to me like far shy of what someone would need to train or to retrain a model. Like what's the amount of data that is significant enough to actually change the results of a model? I assume Tor is going to need a few hundred devices.
Well, I have seen, you know, successful demos with as much as, you know, a few tens of input images. I think typically for production quality, we recommend 100 images or several hundred images. But it's certainly not the case that you would need tens of thousands of images to do transfer learning on a model that's already been pre-trained.
Well, especially for something that's so discrete, right? I imagine that if you're training, you know, to recognize dogs, there's all kinds of dogs. Every dog is different, right? You would think that two instances of a Pixel 4 are going to look pretty similar, right? So it seems like it's a much more discrete data set, which is probably easier for it to learn to distinguish, right? Than if there was like continuous, very organic growth of these devices where every phone was really unique.
Well, so the number of images that you'd require to retrain the model is very much dependent on the number of labels that you get on the other end. So if you're training a model to classify between, say, you know, a pixel 3 and a pixel 4, that's a very different thing to saying, I want a classifier for, you know, all the Android devices out there today.
If I had just one instance of each device, it would probably still do a reasonable job, I would think. Let's say, I'm not saying it can predict what a different device is, but if I gave it sort of all Nexus and Pixel devices, one of each, and I added that to the object classifier, what's your intuition about how good that would be at recognizing in a different photo of the same phone, but like at a different orientation? What do you think is the likelihood that it would get the right descriptor, the right label?
I think giving it one image is probably a little bit on the skimping side, if you will.
I'm an optimist.
How many
pixels do you think I have laying around?
Well, you can use, you can produce a number of images, several images of the same pixel, for example. You can also use a technique called data augmentation. So, you know, you rotate the images and then use them in the training process. Just to be clear, if you give it, you know, one picture of a Pixel 3 and one picture of a Pixel 4, the neural network will actually learn how to recognize between the two. It's just that having only had one iteration of this, you know, backprop that I described, it probably won't be the most accurate of networks.
Yeah, that's where I was just hoping that deep model of like learning how to segment the object. The object, all those other layers are basically teaching it a lot about rotation and things. And so that at that last layer, it would, or last few layers, it would really kind of come down to very specifics about the device.
I think you have to use the keyword enhance. That probably helps a lot.
That's right. Click enhance repeatedly.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's really important to remember is that, let's say if a human can't tell from the photo that which phone it is, then it's unlikely that a ML model would be doing better. So sometimes we need more than, say, a black rectangle to determine it. And here actually is one of the tips that I gave a lot of developers is, hey, if you can control the input of what you get, then you probably have a lot better time in terms of training a model. So for example, if you are going to determine from a production line standpoint, you know, between apple and oranges, then it's great. But if you try to kind of create a model that is something and not something, that's actually quite hard, because the not something is essentially the rest of the universe. So it's hard to basically get the model kind of correct in some of those cases. And a lot of people that is trying to, for example, do recognition of an object is having a hard time to do that.
I think we've all seen those pictures, right? Where they take photos that are very similar. I can't think of an example now, but like there's pictures of cats and there's pictures of like blankets or whatever, right? And it's often sort of a very fine line, you know, what the two look like. So once I've trained my model, how big would something like an object classifier be on the device?
That actually very much depends. Again, that there's a spectrum. So we have seen good results with what we call quantized models at around, say, 4 megabytes, 4 or 5 megabytes. Some of the larger models that we have seen are, you know, around 80. Matteo, I don't know if you have got anything to add on that kind of front.
No, I think you can get pretty good results with an on-device model that's a few megabytes in size.
I see. Is it one of those things where I could... you know, have a where I can make the trade-off based on, let's say, the user's available space and or device size. You know, like if I'm trying to think of an example where we ship, for example, you know, with app bundles, we will ship different density icons to you based on what your device has. And I'm wondering if it'd be practical to notice that on low-end phones, you know, maybe you don't want a 100 megabyte neural network. But maybe if you are on a high-end phone, we would make that trade-off. Is that the kind of thing that's easy for developers to do?
So that's actually a very important question. So of course, getting to a model is, you know, one part of the task. And you can do that by transfer learning. You can use tools like TF-Lite Model Maker or AutoML, or, you know, if you have the expertise, you can even, you know, train your own architecture from scratch. Then you get to the question, okay, what is the best way for me to actually use that model in an application for, you know, what are my features? And, you know, if we stick to the object detection and tracking example that we talked about earlier, obviously, you know, many apps use this for example, for like a shopping experience where you point your device at an object in store and then it will bring up all the information about the model. You know, you can click a button and you will get the right size to try on, et cetera, et cetera. When you decide how you want to deploy your model to a large number of different devices, you know, some may be flagship, some may be more towards the sort of medium, lower end of performance, the size of the model does in fact matter. And it's a perfectly reasonable strategy to have multiple versions of your feature developed for the different types of Android devices that you might want to serve.
Yeah, I can imagine maybe it's not even disk space that's a factor. Maybe, you know, network speed would be a bigger thing, you know, if you're on Wi-Fi, and, you know, it's maybe not as big of a deal as if you're on a metered network, you know, in the store. when you're trying to download this thing, maybe you don't want your shoppers to have to wait 5 minutes to get this massive model, just to have accuracy.
I'm also wondering whether there's like with images, like the idea behind MIPmaps, where you can show a low res, and then as you get closer, you know, high res, you have several versions of these things. Like, is it possible or foreseeable where you could basically have larger versions of the model and then download, you know, if you did a match on this, then it's, you know, you need a bit more information, so you download the next increment of the larger one? Or are they just completely separate models and you just need to choose at runtime which one you want to download and use?
Well, we actually, when we built on the BiSAML features, we actually designed with that in mind. Again, if we go to the object detection and tracking feature, which, by the way, is a turnkey API ready to go with MLKit, even if you happen to have a custom image classifier, you can just plug it in. So the way that feature is being built is that on an image frame, you would perform object detection, and then we would pass the results of that object detection to a much smaller tracker model that tracks the object as it moves, you know, left, right, up, down on the screen. And by using that sort of model architecture or feature architecture, we can actually make sure that this feature runs super well on the majority of Android devices.
So I noticed in I was playing around a little bit with some MLKit a few months ago with, I don't know, simple doodles I would make, and then I would do a detection on that. And I noticed like the results I was getting from those little doodles were much closer when I used cloud detection. I think it was Firebase APIs, correct me if I'm wrong here, versus the on device. And I assume that's just because, well, we have a necessarily smaller model to do inference on the device.
So yes, MLKit is all about on device. So if you use MLKit, none of that data goes to the server side. It's also perfectly free. It's one of the advantages of MLKit. For object detection and tracking, a typical pipeline is actually that you have, for example, in a situation like visual search, in a store, is that you perform the initial classification offline, and then you actually, of course, go server-side and do a search in your product catalog. If I give an example from, you know, a general store, maybe you would produce an initial classification in the order of, is this a food item? Is this a bit of furniture? Is this, you know, footwear or clothing? And then you would use that to look up into an online product catalog and then serve that back to the customer.
Yeah, and maybe one additional point to add in terms of the trade-off between having on-device model versus cloud device is, for example, how many different categories can you accurately differentiate between? So, for example, we have image labeling in both on-device version within MLKit, and then Firebase also offer a cloud-based image labeling API. So the Firebase API offer 10,000 labels, whereas the on-device API offer 400 labels, but it does not require network to use it. So for the developers that's thinking about this, they need to think about that kind of trade-off. And if you have more labels, you might think, hey, that is more accurate because you get to finer grain kind of results. Whereas with the on-device model, you might get a high-level result, and you might think, hey, for your particular use case, that's not sufficient. And in those cases, I would do basically what Matej just suggests, which is to do maybe a bit of both, so that you don't send every single frame of what the cameras see over to the cloud, but instead have the object detection and tracking API doing the initial shifting. And basically draw a rectangle on the screen saying, hey, telling the user, hey, is this the image that you want me to detect? And then you send it over to the cloud to basically save on that network cost and that latency.
I think there's another path of inference that I was led down from this example where, so it was clear that the model in the cloud, which would eventually cost money, you know, depending on how much I use this thing, had more information, therefore it could get closer to the pictures that I was drawing with these doodles. than I could on the device. On the other hand, the number of things that I was going to draw with these doodles, it was like, you know, either letters or numbers, was so small that it seems like I would be better off in the long run actually creating a custom model, like going out and training a model, you know, in the cloud or wherever, downloading that. And then that model could be small enough to be used by MLKit directly, because it really didn't need to detect that many things. But the problem was, if it only had 400 from a universe of infinity, then it wasn't going to be very effective. But if it only had to detect, let's say, 26, but I could pre-train the model, then that probably would have been the best of both worlds, except for, you know, the work that I would have had to invest in training the model to begin with.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is the cost of training the model, but I think with, you know, the tools that we have available now, it's actually a fairly easy thing to do, provided you have some data. So on-device ML itself has a lot of advantages. So everything happens on-device. Your feature will work where there's no connectivity. Typically, the overall latency is much lower because everything happens on-device. So there's very many good reasons to actually use on-device ML in your features.
Yeah, and just to add, kind of, you know, privacy is one of the things that our users really care about. And, you know, if the processing happens on-device, then, you know, the privacy side is assured. And just want to kind of really highlight the point that Matei just said around latency, because if I just say, hey, it's low latency, then it's like, oh yeah, thanks, that's nice, because, you know, it's a speed. But for me, what low latency means is actually new user experiences. Because if you can feed back to the user immediately what is going on, then they can actually correct. So again, sorry to keep repeating the really magical, at least in my view, the object detection and tracking API, where the user can see, hey, this is the rectangle that I think I'm seeing in terms of the model that we have. And the user can correct that and say, hey, I'm looking at Tor right now, and I can see his face and his microphone right next to him. But if I move the phone and focus on the microphone, and go, hey, you know, please detect that object, that's the kind of experience that you really can't do with a cloud-based API, where you need a round trip in order to come back and feedback, you know, to the user what they should be doing next.
Yeah, I think in the example I was talking about, I believe when I was doing local detection, it was along the lines of like 2 to 3 frames worth of latency. And when I would go query the Firebase APIs, it would come back in a second or a second and a half, you know, in that particular situation. So it was large enough to cause a significant delay in like a UI-based situation, right, where the user is going to sit there and kind of wonder what's going on, as opposed to a little bit more real-time for on-device stuff.
Yeah, I guess with the Camera X libraries, it becomes really easy too, right, to sort of hook up the viewfinder API and to overlay that with MLKit results, so that it's, you got this really live feeling of what you're pointing at and what the machine can see.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So you mentioned you know, for the user to sort of feed back. How can you talk a bit about federated learning?
I can talk about federated learning. So federated learning, in a nutshell, allows a model developer to train their model without actually using you know, personally identifiable data. So it uses a protocol called secure aggregation to sort of do the learning part, so the training part on device, and then it ships model updates up to server side.
So I feel the need to go back to something. I should have done this at the beginning of the episode, but there are so many terms that overlap that I would love to like get a clearer definition and delineation between them. So I'll lay out the things that have confused me in the past, and maybe I'll admit that they still confuse me in the present. So there's TensorFlow, there's also TensorFlow Lite, and the difference between those, because it seems like we only deal with TensorFlow Lite. That creates the model that we then download to the device. So then what's the distinction between those? There's we've been talking about MLKit for consuming for doing inference on those models. Is there anything about TensorFlow that runs on the local device, or is MLKit the wrapper on top of that? And then something we haven't brought up as well, but we've talked about in terms of new features in the Android 11 release, is NNAPI. So I'll just toss this out to the experts and say, what?
Yeah, that's okay. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and say the exact same thing. Don't worry about it. So, Yoki, your first question was on TensorFlow and TensorFlow Lite. So TensorFlow Lite is part of the TensorFlow product offering. So TensorFlow is a both a training as well as an inference product, and it runs typically server-side. TF Lite is the mobile offering of TensorFlow. It currently does not do on-device training, so it is an on-device inference engine that you can use to run models on your Android device. We think of TensorFlow Lite as the recommended inference engine for Android. So if you've trained your own model, or if you've downloaded a model from, say, TF Hub or from other sources, you can use TensorFlow Lite. MLKit also uses TensorFlow Lite underneath. The right way to think about MLKit is turnkey on-device APIs aimed at application developers who may not have the ML expertise to train their own models. For example, object detection and tracking, no need to go and train your own model. An excellent one is provided through MLKit. And then, like I said, actually does get passed down to TensorFlow Lite, where the inference actually happens. And I believe you mentioned the Android Neural Networks API, which is an Android platform feature. So the Neural Networks API tries to help with this fundamental issue of how do you get the best possible performance and power efficiency, also very important, on a particular device. So the goal of the Neural Networks API is given a model, it will select the right hardware to run it on so that you maximize for performance. For example, a lot of the models that we discussed run much faster and with much higher power efficiency if they, for example, run on the DSP as opposed to the CPU.
Okay,
and so I'm assuming that TensorFlow Lite will already use the Neural Networks API then. That's not something I have to worry about as a developer.
I think on that one, you need to opt in. So by default, TensorFlow Lite actually runs on a CPU. And we provide, as part of the TensorFlow Lite library, something called a NNAPI delegate. So you basically, as a developer, you can opt in to use it.
Why is it opt-in? Is there a con to using it?
So sometimes it does depend a little bit on the exact model that you're running. So what we recommend with NNAPI is developer try to use it on a representative kind of list of testing devices that they have or the user base use, and see if there are kind of performance kind of increase and acceleration. Because we do find that there are edge cases where, for example, if the model itself does not all fit into memory, or if a particular opt is not supported, then maybe the CPU kind of running via CPU is more versatile. And also, as the CPU inference improve year over year, that has also kind of narrowed those kind of choices kind of between running it via the CPU route and via NNAPI. But like Matei said, a lot of the popular models, NNAPI does support those.
It just seems like something that the delegate should maybe consider, you know, that it should go, hey, it looks like this model doesn't fit in memory. I'm going to fall back to CPU, as opposed to making that a setting I have as a developer have to worry about.
Maybe we could train it.
to learn. Well, I mean, machine learning model to figure out what to do.
We actually joke about that a lot within the team. You know, how do we solve this problem? You know, we'll just use ML and we'll train a model. But coming back to your point, Laura, that's a very, very good question. That is indeed where we would like to get to, so that we take all of this complexity away from the developer. So you put a model onto your device and the rest of the stack should know what to do.
So I'm going to test myself here and see if I understood what you said about all the terms and how things work together. So as a developer, as an Android developer, if I want to use machine learning, I'm going to start, well, if I want a custom model or if I need to do custom training, I'm going to use TensorFlow on the cloud to create that model, right? And that gets downloaded onto the device. And then once it's on the device, then I have a choice. I could actually use TensorFlow Lite directly. Is that a native API? Is that in C?
I just feel like what you said there, it gets downloaded. Like, I thought of these models as being bundled with your app, like as an asset.
Okay. Sure. However it got there. I'm just saying, like, we've got this thing. We've got an artifact that got produced in the cloud. And then I need to get it onto the device, yes, as part of the app. So I could use TensorFlow Lite directly, correct?
Correct.
And that's a native API, right? But we don't necessarily recommend that people go directly there because it sounds like we have value add in either the neural network API stuff for performance reasons, which is also a native API, or an ML kit, which A is at the Android SDK level, if you happen to be writing your app in that Java or Kotlin, as well as bundled models that you could use instead of the custom model. Go ahead.
So if you've trained your own model, say you've customized an existing pre-trained model and you now have a TF-Lite model that you want to build into your app to power a certain feature. There's essentially two ways to go. One is you could go to Android Studio. You could import that TF-Lite model into Android Studio. Android Studio ML plugin, which we launched recently.
Studio 4.1.
Will read the metadata of the model and generate the appropriate code to use that model, so that all you have to do from your application is to call into a high-level API that was produced by the plugin. Now, if this is a feature that is also available in MLKit, for example, object detection and tracking, that's an even faster way of doing it because that's already pre-built. The API is hopefully well-known and well-tested, and you just take your model, you bundle it into your app, you tell MLKit, hey, this is what I want you to use for the image classification or image labeling. And you use the feature in the exact same way as if you would with a prepackaged model.
Okay, so you tossed out a new thing. So the Studio 4.1 feature, what was that called again?
I think officially it's called ML.
Model binding?
Yeah, model binding. So in the build or Gradle, I only remember the build or Gradle kind of option. It's like ML binding.
I can actually talk about this because I just did a demo of it. So there's two steps. The first one is to turn on ML model binding. And there's a simple method to do that with the DSL. So in Studio 4.0, we have this new general concept where you can specify build features. This is not just for ML model binding. This is where you would turn on data binding or turn off build config generation. So basically, there's a build features block. And one of the new things we've added there is ML model binding. So step one is turn on ML model binding. Step two is to drop your model into the new ML source set. So just like we have source main Java and source main REST and all these different source sets, there's now an ML source set. So you drop your TensorFlow Lite file into that folder, source main ML, your model.tflite. That's all you have to do. When you build now, it's going to generate a bunch of new classes that are basically wrapping the model and gives you really nice accessor methods for running process on the model and for also, pulling back out the data from the recognition process.
Yeah, and just want to kind of add to kind of Tor's point about all this tooling that's available in 4.1. The easiest way to use it would be to go through File New, and just like when you when you add your vector asset or etc., there's now a new category under Other called TensorFlow-Lite, and when you click on that, you basically choose the ML model that you've created, in the cloud, etc. Say this is a TF-Lite model that I want. Then it actually do all the configuration for you. It will insert, hey, ML binding, equals true. You will see kind of the dependency being imported, added, and all of that is done for you. And then the next screen that you see is actually an overview of the ML model and say, hey, these are the input and these are the output. And at the bottom, you even see a code snippet of basically how you use it in Java as well as Kotlin. Yay!
So this is like a whole other API surface then. So what is it actually using? It sounds like it's using like generated code sitting on top of TensorFlow-Lite. And maybe this is like, we've been talking about MLKit this whole time, but is this actually the recommended way that people in 4.1 and going forward should be?
I think this is for when you have your own TensorFlow-Lite file, I think.
Okay. So for custom models. For custom trained models, yes. As opposed to the built-in stuff that MLKit offers. Is that right?
Right. So this is definitely for custom model. And I would say that this is, basically a cross-collaboration between the Android team and the TensorFlow-Lite team. So the runtime and the support library, a lot of the infrastructure is basically done by the TensorFlow-Lite engineers and team. And then on the Android tooling side, the Android engineer has basically done a really good work in terms of integrating all that support library goodness kind of into Android Studio and generate all the code from the metadata that has been kind of included into the model. And then with MLKit, then yes, there are two scenarios. One is, hey, I just want to use the default that is from Google. So I'm really happy with the 400 labels I get, or the default five category of object detection and tracking, then no work required. You just use the API and then that's it. But one of the feedback that we've heard from developers while using those two MLKit API is, hey, I just want that extra one category, or I just wanted that slightly different detection. So that's why, and this comes across as something that's really differentiating is for the object detection and tracking, because it doesn't just kind of classify the entire image. It actually tries to section off different bits of the image and say, hey, that's an object, that's an object, that's an object. And after that step, if you can perform the classification on those particular discrete sections of that object, then that's basically the value add. So if you have a complex picture, or if you're trying to get the user to focus, or get the phone to focus on a particular part of the feature, using object detection and tracking together with custom model is a really shortcut way to do that. So it really depends on the use case here. If you want to do like a whole image classification, then the model binding that we just talked about in available in Android Studio 4.1 and a lot of ML developers so far from the TensorFlow developer ecosystem have been kind of using that method. You can continue to use that method, and we have made it easier. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have the MLKit developer that have been saying, hey, I just wish that I could classify that little bit of the MLKit function. Now we have a route. So the two kind of meet somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and you have a lot of different things you support in MLKit, right? So object detection is one obvious one, but can you talk about some of the other things that you do?
So MLKit today supports a number of computer vision as well as natural language APIs. I think if we go through the vision, and Hoi, correct me if I get it wrong, I think it's barcode scanning, there's face detection, obviously image labeling, object texture tracking, which we've been talking a lot about, as well as high-quality on-device text recognition. It's a pretty well-used API.
I'm so happy, because that was something that I needed a few years ago, and I was looking for libraries. And it was really hard to find libraries pre-ML that did this. And now it's just built in to ML.
Oh, you should definitely try it. The text recognition API is amazing. It's really, really good. But then on the natural language side, we've got language identification. This is a very commonly used feature. Before you do anything with certain text, you want to figure out what language it's in and if that's something that that you can process. Then there's the smart replies, which you already mentioned. And last year we launched on-device translation. So this is, I believe, 40 languages. So the full power of Google Translate offline.
Wow.
Shipped through MLKit.
That's available in MLKit?
Yes. The on-device models for translation have been available through MLKit since mid last year, I believe.
Yeah. The promise of Babelfish is finally here without the fish in your ear.
Well, I would say that the on-device models, again, if you compare them to the models available through cloud APIs, obviously it's not quite the same. There are certain trade-offs that we've had to make to field those on-device, but it's pretty amazing. We're quite pleased and work is still ongoing to further improve the models.
So we should probably let you go and implement more amazing things. Did we forget to ask anything that you wanted to mention?
Actually, maybe one last thing that I want to kind of give a shout out to, our very hardworking ML design team. So they have done, or we have worked on two things together. One is around the People plus AI guidebook, which lay out a lot of principles around how to design for machine learning, in particular, how to kind of handle the edge cases, because those are no longer edge cases in ML. You need to deal with accuracy. Even if you're 95% accurate, that is still much lower than kind of conventional programming, where we expect 100% or 99.9% kind of accurate. So a lot of really good tips in there. Share it with your designers and PMs. And then for particular use cases, the MLKit team have worked with the material design team to come up with really great examples of how you basically do object detection and tracking. And you can basically just copy and paste those code from the samples. So find us kind of under Google Sample, under MLKit, there are showcase apps. We call them showcase apps. Just look through those and run them.
I'll get the links from you. We'll put them in the show notes. So if you want to know where he's talking about, it'll be in the blog post. I think that's it then. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.